Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. We have a very important interview for you today. You've been reading about David A. Hughes, who is a scholar. He's been Hero of the Week. His book has been promoted heavily. I'm going to keep on promoting it. And our topic today is navigating psychological and neurological warfare. And I have to tell you, David, I think you have published the definitive scholarly work on this topic to date.
Thank you, Catherine. So, or at least volume one.
Right. And the title of the book is part one. So it does include part one in there. You know, this is an evolving field, but I just want to mention why I'm so enthusiastic about your work, because it integrates so many disparate threads and brings them together and organizes them and looks at them from the viewpoint of the people doing them. What are they trying to accomplish? And so you really see and dive into all the different areas where consent is manufactured and manipulated. And, you know, it's many different things. It's hard and it's soft. You don't go a lot into the financial incentives, although you mentioned them, but it's really an extraordinary effort. And I just want to give some background. There was during the, a year or two ago, there was a group of us who were very offended by the effort to use a theory called mass formation to explain what had happened during the pandemic. The idea being that somehow totalitarian was the result of a psychological eruption on the part of the population, the general population. And we did a series of interviews, Ulrich Groniger, who runs our Future Science series, and I. The first was called Control and Freedom Happen One Person at a Time, which got into the techniques that are used to manipulate one person individually and how you know, sort of manufacture consent so that it looks like a mass thing, but it's not. It's very engineered, and it's engineered at the individual level. Then we did something called the economy of the energy body, which I want to talk more with you later. And this debate erupted about mass formation versus mass atrocity. And the debate was ended with mass atrocity winning the day in an incredible article that you and two co-authors published through Unlimited Hangout, Whitney Webb's website. And it basically cut through the disinformation and the lies with extraordinary scholarly effort. So before we get into the book, how did that article happen? And I guess it was part of the book happening. So tell me, when did David A. Hughes decide, because you have an extraordinary background in international relations. Let me go. You have 2 degrees, right?
PhDs, yeah.
PhDs, and one's in international relations.
That's
right.
Yeah. And the other's in German studies.
And German studies. So you're looking in a very scholarly way at international politics. How did you take the turn and fork into the sort of the engineering of consent in this way?
Well, I've decided to write the book in July 2020. It's taken good kind of 3 years of hard intellectual and emotional labor to complete it. And during 2022, of course, I became aware of Desmet's book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism. When I first heard of it, I was very excited because I thought, wow, this is great. This is essentially what I'm writing on as well. Very similar topics here. So I was really eager to delve into it. And I have to say, I've barely ever been more disappointed by any book in my whole life. Only the middle third really deals with anything approaching the psychology of totalitarianism. There's a great deal that it doesn't cover. It's blind to the atrocities which have taken place since 2020. The concept of mass formation itself appears to have been plagiarized from Freud. I get into that in our co-authored reply to John Waters called Global Class War and the Politics of a Hatchet Job. If you look at section 3 there, you see it's an intellectually bankrupt concept. It's highly outdated, over a century or so old. None of the kind of modern psychology literature on atrocity is cited anywhere. And I was really struck by the amount of publicity that Desmet was getting. Everybody's heard of him. Many people that I speak to automatically cite him as an authority. But from my perspective, through two careful dissections now of his work, and we also produced a video about it as well for Doctors for COVID Ethics in late 2022, it's a very intellectually flimsy theory that ultimately works to blame the victims and exonerate the perpetrators.
One freedom fighter calls it sudden darlings. You'll get a flimsy theory that suddenly gets tremendous attention, and it's all very coincidental.
That's right. And again, when these ideas are suddenly everywhere, and I mean, for somebody like Desmet, he's appeared on so many platforms, he's had kind of slick documentaries made about him, he's relentlessly promoted by other well-known figures like Robert Malone. The whole thing is kind of suspicious, because nobody's ever done that for me as a fellow academic.
Right.
Nobody said, hey, do you want to come and feature in a slick documentary all about your critique of Desmet? It never works in that direction. So there's almost an inverse correlation between the heavier that certain ideas are promoted, that the less likely they are to be true.
So what happened was Malone added the word psychosis and it became mass formation psychosis. Right. And there were suggestions that this was the reason the CDC and FDA had done what they'd done. They were simply part of a mass formation psychosis. And that's when a major effort, got really underway. And we were so grateful for your scholarship. Okay, so let's talk about the book, because I think, if there's one thing I could communicate to the people watching this, how important it is to access David's book. I'm told it's available in a hard copy as well.
It is.
So you can download it from the internet, but how do you get hard copy?
Well, it's available on Amazon and through the Springer Nature website. The hard copy, however, I mean, here in the UK, you'd have to pay £109.99 for the hard copy. All of that goes to the publisher, not a cent goes to me. But the good news is that I was able to secure some open access funding for this book. Again, all of that went straight to the publisher. But what it means for the public is that anybody can legally download this book and redistribute it for free under a Creative Commons 4.0 license.
Right. So I would strongly recommend you download and you read this book. There's a link so they can make a donation. I would recommend a donation for sure. And so let's step through it, because you do a remarkable job of going back through the history of essentially official persuasion, and you look at it in an individual level. So you go through the history of MK Ultra and these other techniques, but then you bring it down to modern times. So step us a little bit through the outline.
Okay. Well, I begin essentially just after World War I with the Tavistock Institute, which realized that the phenomenon of shell shock, which was novel during World War I, would place victims in a state of psychological malleability. So you could manipulate their minds a lot easier than you could a normal person. So the Tavistock Institute, with Rockefeller backing over the course of several decades, explored more and more ways of exploiting techniques of shock and stress to produce these states of psychological malleability. That kind of research, of course, then fed into the MK Ultra program in the mid 20th century. And over time, particularly when we get into the 1960s, you see the same actors then looking to apply these techniques, not just at the individual level, but at the group level and ultimately at the societal level. So this brings us then into the 1970s and what Naomi Klein refers to as the shock doctrine. And she discusses that in relation to what she calls disaster capitalism. So
I want to stop you just for a second, because it's interesting. I was just rereading Shock Doctrine this week, and we're about to do a series of write-ups of the different case studies where it's been applied. And what was developed along with this was economic models where you could profit enormously from shocking a population. So shocking a population is not just about instituting political and cultural change. It's about grabbing assets.
It really is.
And asserting more control of the economy.
Yeah, and we right. see that illustrated very well in the case of the 1973 coup in Chile. It wasn't just about opposing Allende and a socialist government. It was also about instituting the first experiments in neoliberal economics in Chile, backed by a brutal dictatorship. So those are the origins of this. And then, of course, we see similar ideas being played through via 9/11 and the war on terror and all of the business opportunities that created. And again, a similar principle with a kind of shock and awe operation, as I refer to it, in 2020 with the lockdowns.
Now, did you know it was a shock and awe operation? Were you clear that this was engineered in that way?
Not immediately, because the nature of shock and awe is precisely that it shocks you and it leaves you in a kind of state of profound disorientation. However, I did understand that there was something deeply suspicious when, on the 23rd of March 2020, the UK Coronavirus Act, which is about 600 pages long, appeared out of nowhere and magically sailed through Parliament and received royal assent within the matter of hours. And of course, it would have taken a long time to produce this document. Even Matt Hancock admitted it had been months in the planning. And what it immediately reminded me of was the USA Patriot Act after 9/11, another vast piece of legislation just waiting to go. And then you have the shocking event and then it's rolled out and nobody has a chance to protest. So I saw the similarities. I understood that there was something wrong, but it's taken me quite a bit of time to tease out just how dark and nefarious the techniques are that were applied.
So just walk through your trajectory of your research. So you started at World War One, you go through the 70s in shock and awe, but you also did deep dive on both the techniques of how I mind control a person individually, but then also how I do it to a whole society. So you go from literally MK Ultra to neurological weaponry, and you do a lot of deep scholarship on that. That's very unusual.
Yes, the neurological weaponry features towards the end of the book in chapter 8.
What types of kind of neural weapons can we engage and develop? Well, I provide them for you. I don't want to go down into specific granularity as to what each one of them do, because I don't want to give you bad dreams. And you're not going to blame me if you wake up in a cold sweat screaming in the middle of the night. But this is what we can do with these things. Again, let's think here about drugs and bugs. If we're looking at drugs, we're looking at what we call in-close pharmaceuticals. These are not weapons of mass destruction. These are weapons of mass disruption. What they can be used to do is create particular yet highly selective effects in individuals so that they can be delivered at very, very low doses, yet deliver a high amplification effect that's called a hormetic potential, to be able to alter cognitions, emotions, and behaviors. How do you do that? Well, you can work on key operatives. In other words, this individual who's sitting before me may be a diplomat. They are now coming to interact with me. They may have a posture that does not necessarily align with mine. Can I alter their cognition? Can I alter their affiliation? Can I alter their emotionality? And in such a way, might I be able to alter their behavior? Yeah, I can. Moreover, we can induce a number of neuromicrobiological agents to then incur something called high morbidity. These are not necessarily mortal agents. We can modify the existing palette of bacteria and viruses through the use of gene editing techniques, very viable. This has been some of my ongoing work with my colleague Diane DeUlis at National Defense University. And what we can also do is recognize that there are existing microbiologicals that can be harnessed to then induce the effects. We can also engage certain chemicals that way. What we want here is a morbidity factor, not necessarily a mortality factor. I want to make people sick. And what I do here is the virus is not necessarily the bug. The virus is what I put over the internet. Let me show you how I can crash a system pretty easily. I affect key individuals here, here, and here. And then I take another community in the back of the room. I affect key individuals there. And then I take another community. I affect key individuals there. And then I do what every good attributional group does. I beat my chest and take credit for it. And what I put out over the internet is, this is a virus, a bacteria, an agent that I have infiltrated into your fill in the blank. I say it's a weapon of mass destruction. And what I tell you it's going to do is it's going to produce paranoia, anxiety, and sleeplessness. What I've just done is I've recruited every paranoid hypochondriac to think that they have whatever that is. I've used salient and sentinel cases, and I create essentially a legion of what's known as the worried well. They now flood emergency rooms. They flood their clinicians. The CDC responds back and says, no, 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 there is no such a thing. And I've created a schism of trust between the population and the polis.
As we move to the future, what we're going to see, and I've claimed this in other writings and other public fora, and I do so unapologetically again here, is that we're seeing more of our biology as the new battle space. And the brain certainly constitutes an impressive domain of same.
So explain where that could go.
So I think what we're seeing is more leveraging of biological tools and methods to be able to selectively affect targets of opportunity or multiple targets that then can opportunize intent. Targets of opportunity include high-profile figures, individuals who are performing particular functions that may be vital, whose disruption of whatever it is they're doing may then cause force mission disruption or cessation. The advanced party of Vice President Kamala Harris's entourage, for example, key personnel of the embassy, for example. Political figures. But I think there's also significant benefit and value for an aggressor to use these types of engagements and these types of operations more generally in the general public, because what that then does is that prompts the fear of the enemy within.
The bulk of the book is about explicating the psychological warfare techniques which were used against multiple populations worldwide in 2020 and 2021 in particular. But when you look at the history of psychological warfare, it is usually the opening salvo, if you like, in a broader campaign and eventually physical warfare. So my opinion, what we're faced with here is a war. I call it the war for technocracy, an attempt to effect a kind of all of society top-down shift from liberal democracy to technocracy. And
right.
Therefore, you have to be looking ahead and thinking, well, what is coming? What kinds of weaponry could be in development here that might be capable of controlling populations? So one of the aspects about this is we're faced with a numerically minuscule transnational ruling class, which I believe and I argue is now at war in a literal sense against humanity.
Right.
So that's difficult for many people right. to accept. And it's also counterintuitive because you wonder how the few can wage war against the many. Now, it seems to me, given everything that we have since discovered about undisclosed contents in the so-called vaccines, plus a lot of work that I've done with Daniel Brody and Lissa Johnson around transhumanism and military intelligence, that it's entirely plausible. It's not a wacky theory at all when you look into it, that right. essentially black technologies have been covertly funded for many decades, and in particular since around the year 2000, involving nanotechnology to issue in what they called almost a quarter of a century ago the IT bio-nano era. And in very simple terms, what that is about is connecting human bodies to an external control grid via nanotechnology that can be implanted right. within the body. And there's a lot of evidence to show how advanced this was, even in publicly available science. And of course, when you start thinking about potential black technology applications, it's likely to be more advanced still. So this takes us to some very uncomfortable places. And right. I present that in chapter 8.
Right. And I think we'll get into what I call the mysterious ingredients. But let me step back a little bit. If you look at the techniques that were used So you go through the Franklin cover-up, you go through MKUltra, and the techniques that were used to shock or mind control an individual. One of the things you do is you trace some of the research where there's clearly a transference of that technology to much more economic ways of mind controlling a group or a larger part of society. So think of it this way. You know, I have 325 million people in America. I have 70 million in the UK.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay, 70 million. But I can now, through the phones or TV, deliver technology where I can continue to apply these techniques one-on-one, but I can do it, you know, basically I can automate it. And that brings the cost of applying these techniques way, way down.
Absolutely.
And suddenly it gets economic to mind control vast numbers of people. And if you look at some of the research you've tracked, like the DARPA research, that's what it looks like to me. They're researching, how do we take these techniques, which we're doing one by one, and automate them so we can do 70 million people at a time at low cost? Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that in there. And in terms of the economy of it, people will buy these smartphones, for example, of their own volition, spending large amounts of money right. on them. It's quite incredible.
Right.
So when you understand the historical relationship between big tech and the intelligence agencies, and again, I discuss this in the book, but essentially they are one and the same, and they always have been, right. and they've always been aimed at a kind of counterinsurgency project going back to the birth of the ARPANET, precursor right. of the internet in 1969, then all of a sudden these technologies take on a very dark hue, and of course people voluntarily give up all of their data. They can be used for kind of hypnosis, obviously, as we see when, you know, kind right. of all the zombies wandering around just mindlessly glued to their screens. These are very powerful weapons, and unfortunately most right. people seem absolutely addicted to them. And that's by design as well. They were designed so that notifications right. and likes and so on generate dopamine hits, literally chemical reactions in the brain. So all of this is by design. So we've reached a situation now where the smart technologies are already enslaving people. And it's very interesting when you read some of, for example, Klaus Schwab's work from around 2016, 2017, he's already discussing then the fact that, well, we now have these devices which people carry around, and wouldn't it be great if they the similar kinds of technology could essentially go under the skin, to use Noval right. Durhari's phrase. So you can see this gradual kind of internalization of these technologies. And what's so frightening, again, when you read the background literature around this, is that they probably have develop these technologies and maybe already implementing them to actually go under the skin, into the bodies and bloodstreams of people, and potentially into the brains.
Right. So during this period when they're learning to convert this kind of control technology to a sort of a mass economics, another thing is happening. Traditionally, if you look at the economic model that the Western world ran on, they would subsidize their populations by accessing cheap labor and resources in the third and second world in a way that came with a lot of violence. So you're basically extracting value around the world, and then you are delivering a subsidy and a good way of life to your general population. But something happened whereby they said, okay, that game's over, we're going to globalize, and now we have to extract the subsidy from our own population. Mm-hmm. And so you have a fundamental flip of the economics in a way that the general population didn't perceive or see.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and
yeah, it's yeah. I mean, it's almost the kind of limits of imperialist exploitation in the old sense. And when that system is thoroughly saturated, where do you then turn? Well, it has to be right. the domestic population. And it's interesting, for example, right. looking at Alison McDowell's work on, what does she call it, human capital bond markets, the idea right. that you can actually commodify human beings themselves quite literally at the bodily level. So it's quite frightening what they seem to be attempting now. And the natural asset classes as well, trying to financialize the whole of nature. The system is metastasizing from an already highly predatory form of capitalism into something even worse, a global technocracy, which allows for forms of direct control, not just the going direct reset, but potentially direct control over people's bodies or even organs, potentially, or minds. Right. This is what they're attempting, and we should be under no illusion about this, because if they succeed, it does amount to a form of biodigital slavery, and it could potentially be irreversible.
So one of the things, the name you give it is Omniwar, and your new website, which I can't wait for, it's coming, omniwar.org. So describe what does Omniwar mean?
Right. So a lot of people talk about fifth generation warfare at the moment, and I discuss this in chapter one. And in some respects, it's a useful term because it refers to a form of warfare where people don't even know it's happening. They don't even know that right. They are the undeclared combatants in this war, and yet it's being done to them. So that's kind of helpful. But I think that Omniwar is a more useful term because it gets at two things. First of all, the class relations behind this. We're not dealing really with nation state versus nation state in any traditional sense. We're not dealing with kind of counter-terrorism or guerrilla warfare as we were in the second half of the 20th century. We're dealing here with a transnational ruling class which is seeking to use every means at its disposal to subjugate and ultimately enslave the rest of humanity. So the Omniwar concept first of all gets at those class relations, but also it draws the reader's attention to the fact that pretty much every realm of life is being weaponized. Obviously there was the psychological warfare in 2020-2021, but when you look at, for example, what's happening to food facilities, there's obviously an attack on the food supply. The high rates of inflation, I argue, are deliberate in the form of economic warfare to cripple people. As Whitney Webb says, the profession of journalism has been essentially turned into a war zone about just trying to get your ideas out there. That whole information space now is a war zone. And there are many, many other dimensions to this, but essentially everywhere you turn, things are being weaponized against the general population in an attempt to keep it down and keep it in check while this transition to technocracy is forced through.
So one of the things I described, we have a whole series of videos on financial control, and including CBDCs.
Yeah.
And I always like to stress that they can get complete financial control without CBDCs. So it's an all digital financial system that's controlled top down. So when I describe these things, what I say to many audiences is, for our entire lifetime, we've lived in a system in the West where you have a balance of power between the bankers who are running monetary policy, like injecting trillions of dollars that triggers inflation, or on the other side, you have the people's representatives basically managing the tax flows, the borrowing, and the fiscal side of the house. So you have this balance of power between the monetary and fiscal. What a technocratic financial system will allow you to do is essentially take all the laws and rules and regulations of a legislature and executive branch and simply engineer them through the monetary policy.
Yes.
And so the bankers can make, you know, invent the rules and implement the rules totally through the control of financial transactions and simply delete the other side of the house. So it's a financial coup. It's a coup through the financial means. And when you look deeply at how they want to do it, there's a wonderful video by Richard Warner where he describes ultimately CBDC is a chip that they want to put in your hand. And this is what some of the European central banks are promoting. What you realize is, oh, that chip can not only not only control your financial transactions, but it can influence you physically and mentally. And so you're talking about an integration of both the financial incentive systems and, you know, sort of neurological weaponry into one, you know, physical piece of hardware that literally can control your energy body. So it can control your finances, but it can control your energy body. And there's an extraordinary collapse of all the different systems into this one automated totalitarian. It's really, as you said, it's a slavery system.
It is, yeah.
But
one thing to understand about this is the broader historical dimension, because what we're seeing is quite incredible over the course of a span of history lasting several centuries, that essentially what we have seen since, let's say, the American or French revolutions in terms of what some call political modernity or the history of Western republicanism / liberalism, all of this is being rapidly undermined at the moment as they're pressing for this global form of totalitarianism. So the ambition is absolutely incredible, and people should be under no illusion that their rights, the rights of citizenship, as have existed for many centuries, are now under serious attack. We see this, you know, the kinds of actions which are being performed are a direct attack on, for example, the U.S. Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. And it's not just the U.S., it's everywhere.
Yes. And the way I describe it, I used to call it the data beast. I still do. Which is basically the ability to track and simulate an entire population and economy, one person at a time, but scaled up. So you can literally simulate and track the entire economy in real time. And for every person, you can calculate, you know, if you're the ruling class, is this person worth more alive than dead? And that's a very complex formula, but literally you can... If you're injecting massive monetary stimulus into the economy, into Wall Street, you can literally offset it with labor deflation, including with depopulation. And it's very interesting. Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, the other day was giving a presentation and talking about how now we've created a model where you can have growth with a shrinking population. And then he catches himself and realizes, you know, I better be careful. And then he says, of course, that we've discovered this in the xenophobic populations that don't, you know, won't allow immigration, you know, and the implication is we allow immigration, so that's not going on here, which, you know, my interpretation of his body language is he caught himself because he realized.
Sure. Markets like totalitarianism. I think that's what Larry Fink said. Was it back in 2011 or so?
I could argue in the developed countries, the big winners are countries that have shrinking populations. Okay, that's something that most people never talked about. You know, we always used to think shrinking population is a cause for negative growth. But in my conversations with the leadership of these large developed countries that have xenophobic immigration policies, they don't allow anybody to come in, shrinking demographics, these countries will rapidly develop robotics and AI and technology. And if the promise, I didn't say it's going to happen, but if the promise of all that transforms productivity, which most of us think it will, we'll be able to elevate the standard of living of countries, the standard of living of individuals, even with shrinking populations. And so the paradigm of negative population growth is going to be changing. And the social problems that one will have in substituting humans for machines is going to be far easier in those countries that have declining populations. And so for those countries that have rising populations, the answer will be education, and so rapidly develop. You know, for those countries that do not have a foundation of rule of law or education, they're going to be left. That's where the divide's going to get more and more extreme.
I want to ask you for a big picture question.
Sure.
To start off with. If you look around the world, what do we see, right? Global wave of social unrest, democratization of information, it plays a big role in that. Twitter, Facebook, $100 oil, the deepening deficit, the states moving to fight public employee unions, imbalances, currency issues, the lingering crisis in Europe. What does it all add up to?
Confusion. Uncertainty. Markets don't like uncertainty. Markets like actually totalitarian governments where you have a understanding of what's out there. And obviously we're the whole dimension is changing now with, as you said, a democratization of countries. And democracies are very messy. As we know in the United States, you have opinions changing back and forth. So in Northern Africa and the Middle East, we're going to have an uncertain environment for many years until we have an understanding of where this is all going to take us.
When you can track and engineer it on a one-on-one basis, markets like depopulation.
Yes. Yeah. And again, this is right. What this whole kind of technologies of surveillance and data harvesting are all about. And you only have to couple that with a company like Peter Thiel's Palantir and the massive amounts of data processing that can accomplish. When you have that amount of data, quite right, you can model down to quite a minuscule level, quite a granular level, and play out multiple, many, many different scenarios. So again, the power for social control that gives is absolutely extraordinary.
So I, for a while, I tried to study the history of slavery to understand, you know, why slavery gets going and then how it stopped. And my analysis of when the sort of the Anglo-American Alliance canceled the African slave trade, if you look at the problems that was causing them, I believe they have solved all those problems with new technology. Mm-hmm. And so they think they can go back to a slavery model that will be quite profitable for them. Anyway, but that another thing. One of the things you picked up on in the book, which I was pleased to see, was the work of Charles Lieber. And as we know, Charles Lieber was a scientist from Harvard who got arrested in a fact pattern. Whenever I see that fact pattern, I assume that somebody at the Department of Justice wants a whole world of knowledge to get shut up and put in a box and not come out. And so I've always been very curious about Lieber's research. So tell us a little bit about Charles Lieber and how you picked up on him and what you learned from him.
Well, he's a very interesting character. Again, for ordinary people who might not be able to grasp that certain technologies are possible, Charles Lieber published an article back in 2001 in which he talked about a kind of self-assembling computer in a flask of liquid, such that you can pour out the liquid and this self-assembling computer within it will put itself back together essentially and still function. So that technology was already available in 2001 and publicly known. Now, one of the things I argue in chapter 8 of the book is that the principles and the project of trying to create this IT bio nano age in which human bodies can be directly connected to an external control grid, the principles were all set out around the year 2000, and it then became a question of funding research and development to actually make the technologies realizable. And I think that Lieber played a pivotal role in 2011 in this regard, when he managed to develop transistors which could be inserted into human cells. So we're starting to see there the connection at a very, very small level of electrical technologies, essentially, that can go within the human body and exercise a communication function. So it's ever so interesting when you look at Lieber's work, because that seems to have been the moment. Once that was established, that was possible, then all of a sudden, huge amounts of money really get thrown into this kind of research. And I list a whole load of DARPA projects from that time until 2015, when DARPA suddenly went silent on this. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And also the EU graphene flagship project, of course, from 2013. Because going hand in hand with all of this is the potential of graphene and graphene oxide as these incredible novel substances that can operate in amazing ways, superconductors, only one atom thick, and so on. Lots of talk about getting them kind of embedded in neural nets in the brain. And all of this is sold to the public as being very positive. It might be able to help with Parkinson's, for example, or provide a cure for cancer. This is how it's marketed. But of course, it's all dual-use technology, and at least in principle. So if it can be developed and rolled out, it only requires very bad actors to appropriate it, and it could be misused for tremendous harm if this is indeed a covert weapon system which is being developed.
So in early 2020, you know, the first thing I said is don't worry about COVID, worry about the injection. And the second thing I said was it's an experiment. They're trying to figure out how to install an operating system in your body. And I was convinced that getting that operating system figured out and working was more important than depopulation. And as more and more numbers came out, it's looked to me like, you know, they always stack functions. So clearly depopulation, my guess is, was one of the goals. But, you know, I remember thinking or explaining, look, Bill Gates, you know, installed an operating system in your computer and got you to update it regularly with viruses. What is it about this model you don't see? And this was such an alien concept for many people. But the beautiful moment was when Trump created Operation Warp Speed, announced it, and put in charge of it an executive from GlaxoSmithKline. And I proceeded to look him up and discovered an article in 2012 from Financial Times trumpeting this guy as one of the leaders of brain-machine interface.
Interesting.
And I said, what is this about this that is not obvious here? So one of the reasons, and one of the reasons I really think your book is so special, is it's very hard to get good information about what's going on in this area, because a lot of the research and the information and the best sources are secret. Yep. And so how do you begin to get into this in a way that's intelligent? Now, when there's a group of us in maybe over a decade ago who were looking in heavily into the global spraying, and we became convinced they were trying to get things into our body that would literally hook us up to the cloud. And you know, and sort of that evolved into other research about what I call mysterious ingredients in the food, mysterious ingredients in the spray, you know, and we're all ingesting, and it's all life. So the livestock, the plants, all life is ingesting and is getting digitized somehow is what it seemed like. When you tried to talk to serious scholars about this, you just get the door slammed in your face. And yet it was patently obvious that something like this was going on. And, you know, we had to work with huge amounts of anecdotal information, or people just started researching on their own and doing what they could. But it's been exceptionally hard to find scholars who was really willing to take this on and start to assemble the knowledge of what was happening. Yeah. And your wonderful co-author, Lisa Johnson, I know I was part of a group that had a real squabble about this and didn't want to touch the mysterious ingredients. Mm-hmm. And so some of us said, well, we'll just go off separately and research it. And I remember Lisa saying, look, we have doctors all over the world who are reporting all of these strange things in people's bodies. And it's not just from the injections, you know, it's coming from all over. And you have to deal with it because it's affecting people's minds. It's affecting their bodies and they're coming to doctors seeking help. We can't pretend it's not happening. So there's kind of this huge sort of debate. And my impression was Lisa really played an extraordinary role, and clearly you did too, in helping to assemble researchers all over the world who are really willing to dig in and look at this phenomena. And as you said, it's difficult to look into, but I can't think of anything more important.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, Lisa's one of the unspoken kind of unsung heroes in this. The amount of work she's done right behind the scenes on so many levels is truly right extraordinary. Yeah, so we're both part of an international interdisciplinary research team that has been meeting weekly for almost 2 years now to try to get to the bottom of these kinds of issues. And originally the group was convened around the so-called vaccine contents because there were many questions to be asked about that. But over time, more and more different areas of investigation have arisen. For example, David Nixon has been looking at dental anesthetics and finding all kinds of things there which you wouldn't expect to see.
Right.
Issues of environmental contamination, very, very serious. You know, whatever is being sprayed in the skies, again, that's not innocent when you actually analyze the right, the contents of it. So in terms of the so-called vaccine contents, I published a long paper on this in 2022 called What is in the So-Called COVID-19 Vaccines, Evidence of a Global Crime Against Humanity. And essentially what that was a review paper, a very long paper, 130 pages. But at that time, I was able to find 26 different studies by researchers and research teams from all around the world, 15 or 16 different countries, 4 different continents. Most of these researchers and research teams were operating independently, completely unrelated to one another. But nevertheless, they had all published their findings on the internet, typically not in peer-reviewed form, but just in a kind of horrified attempt to make public what they had found. And I pulled all of that together, so all of these findings from about a 16-month period. And what the paper shows is that all of those different teams, their findings converge around some fairly horrific results in terms of right, all kinds of structures which should not be present, including some very peculiar-shaped geometric structures, EMF-responsive structures, a whole array of heavy metals revealed by spectroscopic analysis, which shouldn't be there, structures which self-assemble. I mean, it's really terrifying to think, because none of that was in the disclosed ingredients of the so-called vaccine. Right. So what we're looking at here is a global rollout of a product without informed consent. And it's no accident, therefore, that I think in the United States it's a criminal offence, isn't it, to examine the contents of these vials. You know, they really don't want people to know about it.
Right.
But when you look into it, and if you're willing to do primary empirical research, which good scientists are supposed to be, and not enough of this has been done, certainly not by universities, who don't want to challenge the prevailing power structures. But if you are a serious scientist with a true love of knowledge, you should be looking at this. And when you do, you right. find things which are of enormous cause for concern.
So I just have to inject this because, you know, as you look into these topics, of course, the question is, how does this change your worldview and how do you emotionally adjust to living in the middle of a war? And I used to have a wonderful friend who came up with a ceremony where, so I'm a Christian, and the ceremony was basically to baptize all the nanobots and mysterious ingredients in your body and baptize them in the name of the Christ. And if they weren't willing to be baptized in the name of Christ, they had to leave. And all I can tell you is it made you feel much better.
Yeah, so, well, I think that doing this kind of work very quickly takes you into the sphere of religion and spirituality
right.
because what you come to realize is that populations worldwide have been systematically lied to and abused on an almost
right.
unimaginable scale. And this has been going on. The deception has been going on for decades.
Right.
And this is really conducted by evil actors with evil purposes. And when that veil right. starts to lift and when you start to see this, you can only recognize pure evil. And of course, you right. are then into well and truly into theological terrain.
Right. So I always find at times like this C.S. Lewis to be very helpful. But it's... you know, it's spiritual warfare, and you are dealing with the demonic. You are dealing with evil.
No question.
So let's talk about World War III, because we're clearly in, as you say, in an omni war. But we also see in the last few weeks a real effort to engineer a land war in the Ukraine with NATO, and from everything I can tell, David. My impression is if you look at the Russian army and capabilities and the European and U.S. army and capabilities, this is not a war that can be won, but it is a war that could slaughter millions of Western youth.
Yes.
I mean, we've slaughtered maybe 500,000 Ukrainians. If you just keep going, we can slaughter a lot more young people. Yeah. Any thought? Have you been watching what's happening in the Ukraine or...
Yeah.
the willingness of this group to engineer literally World War III.
Yeah, I mean, I get into this at the very end of the book when I talk about the Ukraine situation. One of the
right.
points I'm keen to make throughout the book is that when you apply a class perspective to what's been happening, you have to think about war in perhaps new and different ways. So, of course, geopolitical conflict persists. Naturally, it's real. But I think it's been clear and increasingly clear for well over a century now. In fact, you could even go back to the Paris Commune in 1871, that more fundamental than that kind of war between nation states, which is waged horizontally, if you like, is a class war which is waged vertically. And it will always be the case that different ruling classes, when push comes to shove, will always come together to suppress working class insurrections and or any threat to their rule. Now, I think
right.
what we've seen over many decades, for example, the increase of the global population from about 1.5 billion in 1950 to 8 billion today, so over a fivefold increase, it's very difficult to maintain control over such a large population. And also
right.
in the West in particular, since the 2008 financial crisis and the impact of austerity and the amount of social discontent that has created, all of which came to a head in 2019 when there were major protests in 35 different countries across the world. That's one in five. And no accident, in my opinion, that all of that was then closed down via the lockdowns the following year. That what we're fundamentally looking at is a global class war in which actually it's the global population itself is seen as the threat and the most fundamental enemy. So That said, it doesn't preclude geopolitical conflicts. It doesn't preclude a NATO war with Ukraine. But the question is, what is the true purpose of such a war?
I think it's depopulation. I don't think it's Russia versus the West. Yeah. I think it's depopulation.
It could well be. It could also have to do with just continual fear and distraction. They may even resort potentially to a use of nuclear weapons. This would create tremendous kind of panic in the system. But are we going to see World War III in the sense that was feared back in the mid-20th century after World War II, in terms of major nation states really going at each other with nuclear weapons, potentially wiping out all of humanity? I don't think we are. I think that everybody loses in that situation. I think the position of the transnational ruling class is far too precarious if such a thing were to be attempted. So in a sense, what we're seeing is just rolling psychological operations, one after the next, using all manner of potential methods and techniques for keeping populations completely in fear to the point of psychosis and hysteria and so on. And yeah, in addition to a possible depopulation agenda, a broader war of this nature would be very useful for essentially distracting and deflecting from the more fundamental agenda, which is the rollout of global technocracy and total social control.
So one of the problems that ruling class has, if you look at the development over the last 100 years, you've had more and more secrecy and more and more secrecy. And that secrecy is combined with the centralization of political and economic control. And it is very difficult. You know, everything gets, as you evolve, everything is focused on risk management and who's has the knowledge to do that risk management, as opposed to refreshing your elites with meritocracy. In other words, meritocracy and secrecy ultimately become incompatible with central control and risk management. And it's almost as though, you know, you have a group of people who have access to the knowledge, but they're getting stupider and stupider and stupider. It's the only way I can describe. Now, they're very, you know, in my experience, they're unbelievably capable and have great intelligence. But you start breathing your own air because you don't have a way of refreshing things, you know, with transparency and with meritocracy. Markets deliver good information, not just to the folks at the bottom, but people at the top.
Yeah, and in that respect, I think it's important not to overestimate the enemy here, that as powerful as they may be, and as enormous as their control over the means of production are, in many ways, I think that what happened in 2020 was rushed and it was botched and it wasn't carried out with the kind of care that they like. So if you go back to 1970, for example, Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book on the technotronic era, talks all about how it's best to kind of go about things very, very slowly, affecting change, you know, over the course of several generations so that the public doesn't notice it. You know, this is how it's supposed to be crafted. Or Patrick Wood, when he's talking about, forget where the original source, but the hard road to technocracy, I think that was another kind of 70s idea, that you should go about these things in a very meticulous, slow, methodical manner. Then all of a sudden we get to 2020 and it's almost like the panic button is hit. And I think Ernst Wolf talked about this in terms of the single most gigantic act of desperation in human history. And I get into all of this in chapter 8 of the book, that as despite the fact that part of the psychological warfare involves conjuring the illusion of omnipotence, in many ways here, we're dealing with a relatively small group of people who are running scared. And furthermore, more and more people are starting to understand the true power relations in this world and what they really look like. More and more people are, in inverted commas, waking up. And once that happens, once you see these things, you can't unsee them. So I think the position is extremely precarious at the moment. It could go any which way. in the next few years. But it certainly does seem like a kind of pivotal moment in 21st century history to me.
So, and that's why I think the more transparency we bring, the harder we make it for them to cooperate.
Yeah, that's right. And that fundamentally was the purpose in writing the book as well, because so much of this is based on deception and using techniques, for example, of trauma-based mind control to make sure that people simply don't see what's going on. You can hide things in plain sight, and the cognitive dissonance will prevent many people from actually seeing it, even when it's right in front of their eyes. So one of the key motivations for writing the book was just to lay it all out in precise, methodical, academic form to help people to see it and to shine a light on it. Because once people do see it, there's no going back.
Everything that is happening, the entire control grid, depends on the neurological weaponry working.
Yep.
So without that weaponry, it will fail. And that's why this topic is so important at the Slayer Report, because we think, you know, you cannot protect yourself from something if you don't see it. And this technology is used politically, it's used financially, it's used in many different ways. If we can see it, if we can come to understand it, if we can protect ourselves from it, you know, then we're back in the game. And that's my goal. Yeah. We win Omnivore. Yeah. And to me, you can't win Omnivore until we figure out how to beat this. And we can't beat it without great scholarship. And that's what you've provided. So, you know, I can't thank you enough, David, because I think this is a huge contribution. I have a wonderful ally who I insisted as soon as the book came out, get the book and read it. And I just talked to him yesterday and he said, oh my God, he said, it's all come together. And now I understand it in an integrated way. I see the game, you know, and he was a whole new person in terms of feeling like he could, you know, he could play to win in this environment.
That's
you know,
as
horrible, right. As dark as, well, you know, grief is the doorway we have to walk through to, you know, to get back in the game. You can't just sit there and pretend that the weapons you're up against don't exist. Yeah. You have to, you know, I always have a pastor I used to love and say, if we can face it, God, if we can face it, God can fix it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's going to take millions of people working together to figure out how to, I would call it jump the curve. Yeah. You know, how do we overcome and deal with these tactics? How do we, you know, how do we deal with them in our day-to-day life at a tactical level? Yes. We can't do that without first seeing what we're dealing with here. And I think your book is the most significant contribution to helping us see the full scale of this, the length of it, the history, and start to grapple with, okay, you know, what there's just huge amounts of research that is needed to figure this all out. Yes. But this, I kind of feel like we're over the hump into a good framework. And that is a fantastic accomplishment.
Well, thank you so much.
I can't thank you enough.
I mean, your words mean a great deal to me, because, you know, that is fundamentally what I was hoping to achieve here. So if I've managed to make that contribution, then
you did it.
I'm really delighted. Thank you.
Well, it also makes it by bringing it in from the, you know, from the secret closet, from bringing it out into the sunshine. I think now a lot more scholars can get in the game.
I hope so.
And you know, if you're researching, you tend to do one piece, or, you know, this piece or that piece. Without an overall framework, it's hard to just pick up one and go. So, but I think this framework allows people to get in there and go. And I would expect accelerating sort of insights on what's going on and what we do about it. So now tell us, just give us two more minutes on what's next for David Hughes, because you're coming into a career shift thanks to the success, or not thanks to the success of this book.
Yeah, indirectly. So my university is laying off 220 staff at the moment, 10% of the workforce. And I'm one of them, it turns out. So it's not directly related to this book, but it is indirectly related. So I was informed that my job was at risk 6 days after the book came out. And I was then placed in a so-called...
What a coincidence. Well, what a coincidence.
It's interesting how these things come together. I mean, I think it could ultimately be for the best, because I personally have come to believe that actually doing research of this nature, which actually does genuinely speak truth to power and genuinely does have a conscience and genuinely wants to shine a light on evil, I don't think that that kind of research is actually compatible with an academic career anymore. I think that the academic system is so completely captured now that it simply can't be done. So anyhow, it is what it is.
So I would note that Solaria's looking at figuring out how we start a university, because we think there
I'd love to be part of that, I tell you.
There is a need for great scholarship and great science. And, you know, we need scholarship and it needs to have long-term institutional support.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and I kind of, you know, I've asked myself all along, you know, where are all of the other academics worldwide doing this research? And there's a lot of scholarship which will help the control system, you know, developing more efficient algorithms to censor and so on. But there's very, very little which is offering any meaningful challenge.
So all the great scholars and scientists who are ultimately going to listen to this interview, how do they find you? How do they connect?
Right, okay. In the short term, for the next few months at least, I can still be contacted at dhughes@lincoln.ac.uk. I'm trying to get a website up and running, which will be called omniwar.org, just using that term again to make sure it's kind of drilled into the head of anyone who's interested so that they really think in these terms. I've got an academia.edu page, which is ulincoln, or one word, ulincoln.academia.edu/DavidHughes/papers. If you have a look there, one of the documents is called Support, and it offers a range of methods for supporting my work. And I really would encourage people, please do support me at this stage, because I need it. My career is now being ended, and everything we've talked about today has been in relation just to volume one of this book. From the very beginning, it was conceived to be a two-volume project. Volume two is already underway. I know exactly where I want to take it.
Can you put up a crowdfund for volume two that we could
I would
promote?
Like to be able to do that, but I would appreciate your advice or other people's advice on a reliable platform to use, because I'm very wary of these payment processors just stealing the money. If anybody can offer some advice on a good crowdfunder to use, I would be delighted to do that. I'd really...
Right. When you do it, you want to give them an option to send a check or a wire. Mm-hmm. You want to give them non-online payment processor options.
Yes.
Some people will
do
that.
I think that seems to be the key to it, doesn't it? So I actually now need the public support to be able to continue doing this kind of work. I, you know, have a young family to provide for and so on. So if people out there do appreciate what I have done so far, and again, I've made that available to everyone for free. And if people want to support volume two and other work that I'm doing next, then please do take a look at that document for support. Those details, of course, will go on the omniwar.org site when it's ready. I'm also going to start a dhughes.substack.com.
So there'll be a paid subscription.
Yeah,
option.
I think. Well, there's going to have to be, because I need to raise the money for what I'm doing.
So the easiest way for people to donate is if you have a paid Substack. It's very easy then to
it would be.
Click and do that.
It would be.
So as soon as you get that up, which can be done very quickly, let me know right away.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, the page is up. I haven't actually added any content yet, but that's coming soon. And then the final thing, I guess, is buymeacoffee.com/DA Hughes. But, you know, any kind of small one-off donations, it doesn't go far enough to fund the book. So
I don't know. You know, a million people giving $1, that's $1 million.
This is true. I'd like to think it would work that way. But, you know, so far, according to the Springer Nature website, 28,000 people have downloaded the book, and 60 odd people have bought me a coffee. So the ratios aren't great. So I'm looking for support to be able to keep doing this work. And I'd be very grateful to hear from anybody who might be able to help.
Okay. Well, David Hughes, great scholarship makes a great difference. And you've made a great difference already. And we're very thankful. And anything we can do to support your work, we're eager to do it, because we think this is the area where in the Omni war, we need a breakthrough. Yeah. And you have, you know, you have delivered an incredible blow to the other team. So I'm deeply grateful. And I just want to thank you for joining us on the Salehi Report. I know we'll have you back. Please keep us posted on everything you're doing. And we will make sure to republish and get the word out to the extent we can. We can't turn you into a sudden darling because we're not an intelligence agency, but we're building one. So, okay. Well, David, have a wonderful day. And again, thank you for joining us on the Salehi Report. Okay.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for having me on.